So how was that, listening to...
Yeah. I mean, a few things came up which have left me right this moment now. That I think that the original sodomy, the crack was so that they could get in. So I don't know whether we went through that, that, you know, people were whole, then something happened. Yeah, there was something else, but I can't pull it out of my mind right now. It might come back.
So how would you feel about if that was a podcast?
Yeah, fine, as long as you just call me Mari H, so no one knows, can make the link.
Sure.
Fine, if you think it's good, you know.
Right, so where do we go from here then?
Yeah, I'm a bit blank. It's been kind of running through my head all day, different things that I wanted to say, but they've all vanished now.
Hmm. Well, I suppose the main thing for me, and I know we did bring it up, but is to try and ground it as much as possible, this kind of material. In the experiential now, because the visions that you've been having, they're experiential, but the things that you're seeing are not, if you know what I mean. The vision itself is real, like we were saying yesterday, like Whitley believes these things, so it's real, but the actual things that he's saying that he's seen may not be real. Whereas, if we talk about the things that we've experienced, I mean, of course, there's some presumption, because we've got this presumption of linear memory and identity and the rest of it, but things that have happened to our bodies, it just seems that that's potentially more grounded. And of course, one of the, or perhaps the main aim of Prisoner Infinity, at least as it relates to UFO phenomena and whatnot, is to try and determine whether it is possible to account for all of this data as a response to trauma, as a psychic response to trauma.
As I said yesterday, the search for the magical, you know, to make the mundane magical, seemed to be a response to trauma, in as much as I didn't fit in, I didn't feel whole, there was a boredom about everything, a kind of emptiness, but not in a good way, in a kind of devoided way, if that's even a word.
When are you talking?
As a child, I felt that there was something sterile and prosthetic about life, and so I went in search of the magical to try and fill that void, which seemed...
So what did you mean when you said in a good way? What was good?
Not in a good way, I mean, you know, that emptiness can be conceived as a good fullness, right. And it wasn't like that, it wasn't an enlightened type of emptiness. It was a literal hole, a literal as if something had been dug out and there was nothing there. Felt very, had no defined sense of self.
Right.
So I don't know whether it really links in, but I sort of felt that it did come from the trauma, the fact that I wasn't socialized properly, I didn't buy the social implant, it didn't work on me. And that I think I said yesterday that I used to look at people and think, how do you know what to do? Why do you have this passion about this particular thing? My friend, she's an artist. She just spent hours and hours cutting up little bits of film to make an installation. I was like, where does it come from, this passion? As though I never had that. Which seems to go back to this being split, being disembodied. You don't feel properly. You're not even in touch with your emotions. So
then the socialization that you were saying you didn't have, that that would be more like the band-aid that you didn't get, or the anaesthetic, because people who are socialized, they're not less traumatized, they just don't notice the emptiness because they've learned to fill it with social mandates, social incentives.
But were they traumatized? I mean, I look at people who function well. I'm thinking of a couple of girls now that I, you know, and they're just so well-rounded, and even though they carry out the same rote actions day in, day out, they do the 9-to-5 job, they seem to enjoy life. And I just think, how is this possible? But then I look at their upbringing and it was idyllic. They had, you know, a lot of support, a lot of positive regard.
Do you know these people?
Yeah, yeah. And
you're sure about this? I mean, I'm wholly skeptical of this description that you've just,
well,
as my listeners will know.
Have you not met these people that just seem to exude a sort of warmth and happiness, and you just think you're genuine, quite happy, well-rounded, you've got lots of friends? No. You haven't met?
No, I mean, I'm not saying I've never met.
There is I mean, she looks at me and says, you didn't sell out, you know, she's searching for something, but she still experiences life as being much more pleasant than I do. And I theorize that that's because she had a mother and a father growing up. She's got, you know, three sisters and they get on. They're very close. So she's sort of been buffered against the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You know what I mean? And so that's just
maybe
a difference I'm trying to draw between someone like me that definitely experienced trauma. I mean, the world is traumatic, but the loving, supportive family seems to mitigate it quite a lot, and the social implant's much more accepted by people who've had this nurturing upbringing.
Well, I don't doubt that this...
Ginge, I'm just doing this podcast there.
I don't doubt that this would be the case, that this is theoretically true. What I'm doubting is whether there really are examples of this. I mean, of course, it's degrees. So I do know people who seem much more adjusted, and they appear to have had much less traumatized backgrounds. I'm thinking of Bill Morrison, who did the podcast. He's always seemed, you know, just relatively, like you're saying, like he had this much gentler upbringing. And certainly, like Dave O'Shana, one of the reasons I mean, he's the only person who came to mind, and he claims to be enlightened and he's persuasive, so he doesn't really count. But he may be relevant insofar as if he did attain some kind of freedom from the constructed identity that we were talking about last time, yesterday, I think it relates to the very low level of trauma in his childhood.
Sorry, the very low level of trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think of school, if you've got two big sisters, you're not going to be like I was, open to bullying, because I'm the eldest. So all these, this sort of cohesive family really tends to, you know, mitigate the trauma that it is to grow up in a society.
Right, but then the question is... how is this really possible, what we know about social engineering and the programs, how far-reaching they are, that we're all being engineered. So how would it be possible for these supposedly functioning families to exist in that context?
I think because there's enough distraction and there's enough pleasure. And there isn't.
What?
Well, there's enough, you know, to do. They've got friends and boyfriends.
So they're distracting themselves.
So they're distracting themselves.
So
and
then it's not...
no works. It works within a society. It's championed. You know, you get a stamp of success if you're a happy, bubbly, lively...
Yes, but they would have been engineered also.
Yeah,
is what I'm saying. So it wouldn't be a genuine... There wouldn't be anything fully rounded about it. It would be a fragment that had successfully suppressed awareness of its fragmentation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you. But they don't go... crazy. They don't have psychoses. That, you know, they sort of, like my mum, you know, live a very designated life. You do this, you go there.
I mean, so here's another, sorry to interrupt, but here would be another sort of criteria or something to gauge or to reality check your impression. But I would say that if somebody was as adjusted as you're saying, that they were fully whole, and I know you did say the fragment, but you were kind of, there seemed to be an element of perhaps not envy, but
A little bit
of that.
I mean, for a long time, I thought, well, they must be enlightened, or what's the difference? And what
This was my point. What I was going to say, that if somebody was in that state of seeming groundedness and wholeness and all the rest of it, because they'd had a good protective upbringing, those people would be very open to an understanding to those of us who'd been traumatized, I think.
No, they don't get it at all. No.
They don't want to hear it at all.
No. And yet there seems to be something more, the less traumatized they are, the more this spontaneous spirit tends to come through more. With me, it was totally, you know, I'm having to think of everything I do before I do it. I'm totally contrived because I want to get it right and I don't want to make a fool of myself. And so it became so mental. Whereas you can see with people who are more maybe naturalized into the society, that there is a spontaneous creative aspect to them that I lacked because of the trauma.
Well, I suppose there is to animals too.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, that's Facebook. I meant to.
So this seemed a bit of a sidetrack from the original question, which was to what extent, okay, it was about taking refuge in the magical.
Well, searching for something beyond society, searching for meaning. And they seem to have meaning. And I'm thinking of these particular people.
Right.
And their meaning is to have babies and to do barbecues at the weekend and to go to festivals. And that's the meaning. And it wasn't enough for me because I couldn't do those things. I couldn't fit into those things. I had to look beyond society's box for meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason to it all, some why. I don't think people ask why.
Because they also have religion to not ask why, you know, to fill the hole with why.
Science is sort of fills the place of religion these days in Western societies, anyway.
Which is the feeling that there are everything has been answered, and if not, it will be. And
yeah.
There is no why.
Yeah.
So, but this, you see, this, that is a mental construct itself. Like the place in which consciousness can reside where it doesn't have to ask why is a prison. Unless it's, we're talking about enlightenment, where you don't have to ask why because you've become the answer. Then that's also a prison. Because the experience of consciousness in a body, And I'm allowing this in a little bit more, like when I'm falling asleep and whatnot, is absolutely incomprehensible. It's the infinite experiencing sensory existence, and that there's an irreconcilable paradox in that.
Which is?
Infinite. Well, we are infinite, and we're like
the body.
We are awareness of everything that has ever happened and will ever happen. But the mind, of course, cannot possibly encompass that. It is deranged by a mere whiff of that.
Yeah.
And yet the body can, in some way. The body can, just as DNA can contain, you know, ancestral memory, whatever, genetic blueprint, the body can somehow contain infinite. Like the awareness of everything that's happening and that has ever happened. And so that's to be in that place of complete incomprehension and of recognizing and being confronted by the impossibility of ever knowing what's happening. That's the human experience.
Yeah. It can be awful, that. I mean, you know, the thought of never finding out, I think that's what drives me, that I might find out, you know, that I want to find out, that I want to know why I'm here and what these visions mean. And I don't want to palm myself off with some pseudo answer like our friend Strieber. I really want the truth. I don't, you know, want a pedestal or to think badly of myself as a demon or as some kind of low life, you know, topic thing.
Right.
I just want the truth. What is this, and what does it mean, and why do I experience this, and why are they all? They're like a comic strip, you know. One takes up where the last one kind of left off.
Divisions.
Yeah.
Mhm.
And they do point to a sort of subtle realm, and karma. Like, you know, I mean, I've heard of another enlightened speaker, and Adyashanti. Have you heard of him?
Yeah.
You know, he said that he had these past life visions of doing terrible things. Which gives me some comfort to think, well, this is normal. We're all kind of messed up, and we have been since God was a boy. And, you know, we're bound to have, if this past life thing is, if there's any truth in it. But then we're everything. So we've been everyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, the brain can't understand this. And yet there seems to be lineages in which the spirits travel. So it's incarnated, not as everyone, but as people down the line, even though it's everyone.
Sure. There is that. There's also the classic schizophrenic breakdown experience, which is identifying with Hitler or Jimmy Savile and believing that,
yeah,
or the other, that I'm the Messiah or I'm the Antichrist. You know, I've been through that.
Yeah.
And I was both. And
And that seems to be part of the perhaps initiatory experience, or the shamanic initiation experience, where you have to reconcile not just your darkness but also your light, and balance these two. That it doesn't seem you can either be evil or good. That the way to ascension is to embody both and to understand, map both sides of these polarities of the soul.
Okay, yes, and they are simply polarities in the human psyche. They're not, they can be projected outward onto the world, and the tapestry of the world can be, or the psyche can be used as a tapestry in which to paint all of these worldly images as a representation of what's happening internally, but they don't really correspond. I mean, the things that are out there in the world, including all the angels and demons in the psychic world, I would say are representations of an internal process. It's all internal. I keep getting this argument on the blog. People keep saying it's not, you can't just say it's all inner, there's the outer too. And there is no outer to consciousness. What's outside of consciousness doesn't exist, because there's no consciousness there. So even if it did exist,
there's the paradox of that there's nothing here but there is something here as well. There's no one here but there is something here. There's a body, there's a mind, there's something appreciating it in time for a little bit of time. You know, I think that the greatest problem I see with the non-dual circles is they try to dismiss the person. Like, mm-hmm. There's nobody here to experience it. Well, if I punch you in the face, you're going to feel it. Who feels it? Something feels it.
Well, there's the body.
Something has a local memory.
But that's why,
so you can look at it from these two views, you know, like the Necker cube or the optical illusion. You know, you can see it from either view, and neither is correct without the other. It's not complete to just say there's nothing, there's only consciousness, but it's individuated in different forms. It's expressing itself in unique ways. There is no two things that are the same, no two blades of grass.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if we're going to talk with words, of course we are, then there's always a contradiction in language, because there's always a polarity. So whenever you say it is all one, you've contradicted yourself, just as if you say I was Hitler in a past life, you've contradicted yourself. So there's no way around that. Language is, you know, it's a virus that enslaves us, and that's just,
I
you know,
found a way to communicate
deal with it, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. But the experience, there isn't a contradiction in the experience. This is what I'm saying, that to experience oneself as a body that is conscious and that exists within consciousness, as well as consciousness existing within it, and that there's a continuum of the inner and the inside and the outside of the body, because consciousness extends outside of the body. There isn't, experientially, there doesn't need to be a contradiction in that.
I'm thinking of the wave and the particle. you know, that we are both wave and particle. We're a particle traveling
exactly
a wave. Yeah. And that I can understand why people say, well, it's not all the psyche, it is other. But then on the zoomed out level, there is no other. But on the zoomed out in level, there is. It appears like there is. It appears like there's somebody here saying this.
Mm-hmm.
But there isn't. Because I'm everything. I mean...
Okay, so... I think I want to bring it to the gap, the hole. Okay, so we both have holes in our childhood now, in our memory, I should say, our memory relating to being children, growing up.
Mm-hmm.
What you were describing was the feeling of emptiness, which was not good, which was a feeling of, well, I'm.
I thought I was soulless or something for
okay
a long time.
Well, yeah, interesting that you took it into those realms, because I didn't. I was going to use the word artificiality, like feeling like somehow artificial or unreal.
Or a robot. Yeah.
Like a robot, okay. So that, in my experience, funnily enough, I used to wish I was a robot because I couldn't sleep and I wished I had a switch at the back of my neck.
Yeah.
So I didn't think I was a robot, but I fantasized about being a robot. But more pertinent to your own experience was the feeling of what's now called depersonalization or derealization, that I felt as though I was not real, that I was a dream, or I was living trapped in a dream. And I didn't think I had no soul, but because the soul was meaningless to me, I was anti-religious, but I thought that I was crazy. Thought there was something fundamentally wrong with me.
I thought I had something missing. I felt like there was something missing for me.
Right. And so in my case, although there was something similar in terms of, yes, I can't just be like everyone else is in society, and anyone who's happy is an idiot, and I had that kind of general viewpoint of society. On the other hand, I've learned to escape the feeling of alienation, derealization, whatever, by finding my own way into society, which was through movies, as you know, if you've read Seen and Not Seen.
Yeah, similar. I mean, again, I could relate to the Marvel characters and wanting to be a superhero and, you know,
right,
choosing your powers, which ones would I like best and
exactly
how would I look.
So magical worlds. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But the weird thing was, this is another strange thing, that I always had this little character that was me that I'd dream and fantasize about, and I'm watching Josh Whedon's Angel years later, a couple of years ago, and my dream turns up in it.
Mm.
And this has become part of the psychosis that, I don't know, have you watched Angel?
No.
Well, there's an old one that comes back, and this is something that reminded me, that it was a virus. That's how they got in, like a split and then a virus or some sort of disease, which is shown up in Josh Whedon's sort of dreaming.
Right.
And yeah, but going back to how, yeah, the magical thinking that you're overcompensating by being special.
Filling the hole.
Getting a persona that you didn't have as well, a special one, because you feel, personally, I'm talking about me, but, you know, I feel less than, so I need a larger-than-life persona to make up for this lack. Because
right,
that seemed to be how you got on in the world, by being confident and, you know, loud and... But it didn't work, because it was coming from lack. It wasn't authentic. It's like trying to push that image that you've taken parts of the superheroes and you've stitched it together, and then you're trying to force it on the world. Well, I was.
I'm high as a kite, I'm buzzing like a bee. There's flowers upon me. Come out, sister, and play with me. Nobody knows what is gone from me.
So then, bringing back to this polarity, the shamanic thing, and your own identification with Jimmy Savile, then, in terms of what we're describing as a psychic fragmentation, like there's unbearable trauma, and we escape from it into this dissociated state, the mind place. We feel the emptiness of that. And we find ways to fill that emptiness with artifice, let's say, of the world, and we embellish and refurbish and customize this constructed mental identity and turn it into an illusory kind of super self, a super ego, as you're saying. But in the meantime, the trauma and what was behind it gets pushed down into unconsciousness, and that becomes spliced together with our shadow, with the genuine psychic matter of the unconscious that is our soul. No? Mm-hmm. And so how is our soul to return to us? It has to bring with it the trauma that created the amnesia barrier that separates our awareness from it. So that shadow content of trauma includes, of course, the source of the trauma, which was abuse of some kind. So as we're trying to reconnect to our soul, we're identifying with the disowned unconscious matter, which includes the darkest, most destructive urges, not really in ourselves, but they've been implanted in us, so they seem as though they come from us, right?
Yeah, which is why I both loathe Jimmy Savile and take on his karma, as I must somehow, to hate that much, there must be the love too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there must be its opposite. I must have come from this somehow. But I was thinking then, as you were speaking, of R.D. Lang and how he describes the psychotic breakdown as the psyche trying desperately to put itself back together.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hold with that, that seems to be, as you were saying, I think, that, you know, as we try to heal, we have to unpack all of these contents of the shadow and see them. And it looks like a psychotic breakdown. It looks crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a unconscious or a part of the healing process, a way the body and mind try to meld back together. I'm not sure I'm really making sense there, but you know, he definitely, well, he had a whole center, didn't he, where he was trying to let people be psychotic in order to,
well, yes, but R.D. Lang, I mean,
was a complete alcoholic. Yes,
well, he was that, and he was also, I mean, I don't go as far as Jan Irvin on this, but I may end up and just really distrusting all of these sources. I mean, I certainly am less and less willing to trust Jung even, and he's kind of the king of all of these disciples that followed after. Obviously I rely on Kalshed a lot, so certainly understanding the way in which the psyche fragments and how it does lead to these dissociative states and etc., all of that material seems to be very essential. But when it comes to actually applying it, then I begin to get dubious, right? Because we know that pretty much the MK Ultra has applied this knowledge, and the shamanic techniques of ecstasy and all that stuff applied them also. They applied them in order to develop cities and superpowers. So
you mean trauma?
Fragmentation of the psyche. So it seems as though, like, one man's journey to wholeness is another man's, you know, Whitley Strieb as sort of imprisonment. And so it's very subtle, the difference between really integrating and actually perpetuating the fragmentation.
Yeah, I think it comes down to your integrity, not in terms of anything moral, but in terms of, do you want the truth or do you want to glamorize yourself? Are you after building platforms to ego?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you really just want the truth? Which is quite dull and boring, really.
Well, it's not dull and boring, but it's definitely, it's non-exciting and non-glamorous, and there isn't anything for the mind to use, because it really is, it's just a traumatized body in which the psyche hasn't been able to indwell, and all those poisons that need to be fully absorbed and digested, which is, there is
painful.
A repulsive, painful.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, it just is.
It is, yeah.
A lot of it, most of it even,
and
I
you're
think,
gonna,
is
a lot
just
of people,
sitting in the discomfort.
Yeah. For years.
For years and years and years.
Yeah. With no guarantee it'll ever go away. I mean, no, who's going to choose that? Not many people, over the sudden glory and followers and disciples and book, you know, and movies and all the worship.
Right. So then when you have visions that you're describing, that there's an overlap there with the movies and the fantasies, right?
Yeah. They seem to appear in those. From
you said
those
comic
sources.
Books, even. You said it was like this endless stream of comic books.
Well,
so,
I mean only in as much as there's a frame and then there's another frame. I didn't mean particularly because I've never read comic books, but it can take the form of TV characters.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it can also take forms I've never seen consciously, can recall I've seen anyway, like the rotting cave of babies. I mean, and it was literally like a projector was shining the Dolce and Gabbana signs and the Chanel symbols. And
so,
I got really paranoid about symbols after that. Like, oh my God, these symbols are like magical sigils that are going to trap our souls.
All right, so yeah, that's good. That's just where I was about to go. So you hadn't heard of Bardo realm, so I brought that up last time, but you know the story of Buddha sitting in front of the Bodhi tree waiting to get enlightened, and how Maya came along and tried to trick him with all these different things. Well, that's similar to what they say about after death, the Tibetan version. Of course, this is Second Matrix stuff, but still, useful metaphor, maybe, that, you know, the consciousness after death, that there are all these traps waiting for it, and all these different images will be presented in front of the disembodied spirit as a way to lure it, you know, like cheese in a mouse trap, into the Bardo realm. So that was my sense then, just then, when I said that your visions were like movies, is that how much is this offering something for your mind, for the constructed identity to get hold of and use?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, just that I've thrown these books away, you know, that it was telling me that all this stuff, there was no truth in it, there will never be truth in words. I mean, there is truth in that,
right?
That no words can be true, right? But so I was going to throw it all away, listening to it. And I'm thinking, by now, woman, you should really realise not to listen to these things. And I think that's what I began to understand. I'd listened to Papaji, kind of saved my life, that I was able to go, just shut everything out and just see the thoughts and not stick to them. But it didn't last. I mean, it was so hard to do because they feel like there's literally a pin, a long 9-inch nail pin stuck in your brain. It's that painful, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These thoughts seem to be forced on you. That, you know, that's what it feels like, that they're literally being put in with a metal rod, hot metal rod in your brain.
Right. Well, you mentioned that as well, the nanotechnology as well. What I was going to say there was about Castaneda. Oh, yeah. Now, one really useful clue, I think, when you're being played and when you're being pulled out of your center is the sense of urgency.
Yeah.
If you're getting a sense of urgency, then
throw them away quickly. Yeah, but it's
whatever it is. Unless the house is literally on fire, then there's something to be urgent about.
Yeah. I thought my neighbours were going to poison my dog, and I was like, "Mom, we've got to get back." And I just wouldn't let it go because the voice was just saying, "Yeah, she wants you evicted because you're a nuisance, and she's going to poison your dog." And flood your bathroom.
Well, you know how people get when they're in crisis. They cease being able to think rationally and they act in these most ridiculous ways. So people will burn to death inside a building because they forget which way to turn the handle, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how we get played.
Yeah.
Mm.
So difficult to not listen to, though.
Of course, well, that's the point. We get the triggers, the fight or flight response.
Yeah.
But at a level or in a context in which it's completely useless. Like, we're not in a survival threatening situation when we're seeing flyers and cosmic conspiracies and all the rest of it. It isn't a house on fire situation.
No, but it really does feel like it.
It completely feels like it because that's how it felt when we were initially under attack, when we couldn't react, we couldn't run or turn the handle or anything because we were completely powerless, infantile. So that's why the only response that works is nothing.
Nothing, yeah. And so it was so funny because there seemed to be a beep and then I could just be silent for about 3 seconds to 10 seconds and it started again, blah, 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 and then it'd be a beep and I was like, that's my cue to be quiet. And this went on for hours. As though, and you've talked about how Strieber can't quite make his mind up whether they're good or bad. At some point through, he's sort of saying that, you know, they've done all these terrible things to him and then all these terrible things were done to evolve me, my consciousness. And I can so relate because although it's so cruel and so hard, it does feel like it's somehow helping me to defragment, shall we say? To come back in. to strengthen my ability to resist, to bring clarity on the situation.
I don't think you need having your ability to resist strengthened at all. I think the opposite is really what's needed.
Surrender.
And that's not an ability, really. Well, maybe it is. But I forgot what I was going to say.
Them being helpful.
So with Strieber. And it gave rise to a thought there that his conflict, his struggle, are they good or are they evil, of course, is the child struggle. Is my abuser good? Is he evil? Is my father good? Is he evil? Is my mother good? Is she evil? That's an unbearable tension in the child's psyche. It can't be reconciled, but it can't be ignored either. If you get imprinted with that, you're carrying it around. It's running your hard drive thereafter. And everything seems like that struggle, to try and identify. And I have this, it's crazy. I listen to music, it's Bob Dylan or whoever, I'm thinking, is he good or is he evil? Really, that's the most trivial things.
The reconciliation is, you're evil and you're good. Everyone.
Well, yes, it's a mental construct, the good and evil. So the psyche is either whole or it's fragmented. The body is either healthy or it's sick. That's a bit vaguer, but anyway, that even those are spectrums. That's not either or. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're saying that this thing is helping you, though it's cruel, well,
I don't know whether that's maybe, his intention, but it's my.
Well, but I just let me finish. I mean, I would say the only as long as you're thinking of it as an it. Well, what is it is the thing, because if it's something outside of you, there'll never be any respite from that bouncing back and forth. Like even when it's ourselves, we're bouncing back and forth. I'm Christ. I'm Hitler. I'm good. I'm evil. But the psyche is what's helping us, and the psyche is us, and the psyche isn't kind or cruel. It's just moving towards wholeness.
And
of course, for the constructed identity, it appears like hell, but that's partly the subterfuge of this constructed identity, is to interpret every experience that threatens it as hostile and destructive and painful, but it's generating its own distress in that regard.
And the psychosis seems to be to come closer to reconciliation, that these measures of good and evil don't exist. And there's a visual component where I can see it doesn't exist. This is mental, I've made it up. Mm. As though, let's call it my own psyche projecting all these fragments. And I'm, you know, bouncing between personas, good persona, bad persona, ugly persona, beautiful persona, whatever. And so the cartoon-like movie that I go through in these psychoses seem to show me that. Look, it's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that I can actually mentally understand it.
Because my
mind's like, I want to know, I need to know, you know.
Right, the mind has to be placated, absolutely. I've done this in this novel that I just finished, actually, just before. That was why I was delayed by 5 minutes, because I was just the final, like, it's done moment. So, and it's interesting because there's a lot of things in there that correspond with things you were talking about yesterday, actually, the way the mind is, this technology, and but that wasn't what I wanted to say, and now, of course, I've forgotten what it was. that we need, in order to return to, in order to experience ourselves as consciousness, as a whole psyche, as infinite even, which of course the mind cannot go there, it cannot complete that journey to the infinite, we have to find metaphors by which we will incrementally let go of the crucial fiction. We will see that it's illusory. You can't just say or be told or see even that our crucial fiction is fiction, because we shut down.
Yeah, I mean, the mind keeps asking the questions until it's got an answer.
Right, so it has to be led. It has to be led through metaphors that will surely show to itself its lack of reality, its lack of sentience, and it will give up.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, it will give up. It will accept.
The slave to consciousness, rather than the, you know.
Well, hopefully not a slave, an instrument.
Well, it works for and services consciousness rather than trying to be the boss and dominating experience.
Yes. Perhaps. I mean, presumably it's still there. I don't think it gets destroyed or blasted out like Whitley would just believe. So presumably it still is there, and presumably it has some use. I mean, I'm very attached to my mind.
Me too.
Understatement of the day. There is something beautiful about it, a beautiful mind.
Yeah.
I mean, the way it can create these narratives, these metaphors, and appear to actually encapsulate experience, even though finally what it's encapsulating is the impossibility of encapsulating experience. That's paradox.
Yeah.
Paradox is all the way down.
Since it's said, it's gone.
Yeah. Well, it's like a good story. I mean, you, once it's over, you, or a dream, once it's over, you can still remember it, but you don't. The spell is broken once you read the end, and of course you remember. Yeah.
Back to reality.
It was a narrative, and it's not even back to reality. Oh, I'm. Because you're just reading a book. Yeah, you're always in your body, even when all your attention is going into the mind. But then when it actually gets trapped in there, it is. It's a hellish situation, and the stakes seem to be unbelievably high, because once upon a time they were, right, as children. It was total annihilation, psychic and physical, potentially physical death and psychic annihilation. Those are the stakes that are sort of embedded in us at a physical level, a physical somatic memory of that. And then what happens is that, because you say we go into all these different systems of thought to try and fill the emptiness and create an identity, we find all the material we need to account for those feelings of intensity, of that there being so much at stake, and we'll end up like Whitley or Castaneda, believing that we need to use this knowledge to not just free ourselves from eternal bondage,
humanity,
but save the whole universe from destruction.
I mean, that's a feature in in the psychoses that, you know, this, what I think and what I do affects the entire planet, and it's down to me to get rid of the radiation.
Yeah, if I don't do it, no one else will. And that's, of course, true at a psychic level about our own healing. If we don't do it, no one else will.
Do you think there's any truth in the fact that, you know, becoming, waking up, getting more conscious affects everyone because we are all one? And there's a lot of people that say that, that it's, you know, the best thing you can do to help the world is wake up.
Yeah, and? I mean, well, does that, how is that, do I believe it? I mean, sure, it's not relevant to me. I mean, it's not relevant to me in my own, I mean, in the challenge of facing my own trauma and my own shadow, however we're going to describe that, of becoming whole, I'm not doing it for anyone else, because that would be dishonest to myself. Like,
do you not feel a need to address the problems in the world somehow? I do. I mean, I hear a lot of people say, well, it's not going to affect my life and there's nothing I can do, and I think the best thing I can do is go and have a good life and stop worrying myself about it. But there's something in me that kind of goes, oh, I can't not look.
No, you can't not look. Absolutely. The world, we are the world and all that. You know, the world, we've co-created this world, so we're complicit in the abomination. So you can't turn away. Of course you can't turn away.
I can't, but I think people do.
Well, they have. They've turned away and then forgotten that they've turned away, and they think that they're seeing the world. And Jimmy Savile did change that. Good for him, you know.
Well, I mean, that is something to be said for the man, yeah.
Yeah, well, it's not. I'm being a bit ironic, but the fact that he was chosen as a sort of whatever it was, I mean, that he was exposed by the powers that be.
Has it made any difference?
For whatever their reasons are, and I'm sure in the social engineering scheme of things, it's all bad.
Nothing sensitized people to it. Yeah.
But for you and I, it has given us a sort of trump card that we can play for people who want to turn away from the world and pretend that no, it's not that world, it's this world. And but actually no, your world has Jimmy Savile in it, so have a look at our world has Jimmy Savile in it too, and it's a lot closer to the truth, kind of thing. But that, it seems to me like the personal frustration with people who are not looking at the world as it is, or not even trying to, and the people who are not recognizing the possibility of their own traumatized state, people, including my readers and listeners, who often say, well, I have no trauma in my past. And what do you say to that? I mean, it's, are you paying attention? Yeah. A, everybody does, and B, if you did, you wouldn't probably know it. So,
yeah.
But there's that resistance is you know, is deep in us. So. So,
it's opposition water, it's invisible, everybody's been through it, and so only in extreme cases are they going to feel it, because you don't know any different. You were just born into a world that's like this, and everybody's on the same conveyor belt going the same speed. So,
and your, I mean, your visions, they make it pretty plain why very few people want to look at this material, this reality, because
it's even worse than that. They are afraid to look. I mean, I post relentlessly about it, and nobody, everyone unfollows me because it's too disturbing.
That's what I'm saying. They're right to be afraid.
Yes.
Like 99% of people would go completely insane. They would have a psychotic break that wouldn't end, unlike yours, which you recovered in time, you know, to be released very quickly. And it was all sounds like a fairly, you know, untraumatic and humorous incident, not to say that, you know,
had moments of terror. Yeah.
You don't want to be careful about this, and that's the thing. I mean, that to see sort of deeper layers of the social engineering, the spiritual engineering, whatever we're going to call it, the way in which we've been engineered. At level, even apparently metaphysical levels, psychic levels, and not become obsessed or even insane, is really, really difficult. So Streber went insane, I'm afraid. Sorry, Whitley, if you're listening. But Castaneda went insane. So you don't necessarily want to... I mean, and so to bring it back to this thing about how this has a not ripple down effect on others and how it changes the world. Well, only insofar as that's not our focus, I would say, because as soon as the focus is outside of ourselves, well, yes, and it's going to become obsessive. The more, like the tonic for obsession seems to me to always bring it back to the ground, really. You can't, it's like digging for gold. You don't get obsessed. If you find the gold, you can start to get obsessed, but, and then you lose it. I mean, you don't necessarily lose it, you might become rich, but you would lose the real gold, which is tuning into the earth and to the body and your own senses, and what the real quest isn't for the gold, it's for the harmonization of the senses by which you find the gold, and mostly it's just digging through dirt, and so it is very grounding, the whole experience of individuation and sorting the seeds of our own experience and our own trauma. Mostly it's grounding, but then if we hit pay dirt and we start having visions or we get confirmation from the world, which is what's happening at my end, so maybe there's a bit of symmetry in us talking now, because I'm getting a lot of validation from out there and being taken seriously by the world, and that's something I've, as you know, struggled to attain. And so
that's something I thought when I finished talking to you yesterday, that I found it very confirming, just to have you say, I've had similar experiences, I don't think you're bonkers, you know, in a kind of subtle way, but I did feel, whoa, there's somebody else that gets this. Well, I've always felt that, really, but...
Okay, well, that's something, it's not something entirely different, but it's certainly at a very low level what I'm talking about, because what I'm talking about is the world actually taking me seriously, and that it sort of validates my identity, as opposed to just I mean, it's good that my experiences, my interpretations are being validated, because then I can move on and go deeper. But there is that potential, that there's ego inflation, etc. And that's what I'm saying. It becomes obsessive. The more we're able to sort of see confirmations outside of us, and we get fixated on those, and then we can become obsessive. So the world, as long as the world is a mirror, then that's great. But as soon as it starts to become something we think is giving us something, as opposed to just clues, let's say, which might seem like a vague distinction, but because clues are
right
meaningful.
Or wrong. Are you on the right path, or have you taken a wrong road? You mean?
Something like that. You see, and of course, even that can become obsessive, because if you think that
it's good, right or wrong,
like you're having your spirituality validated by the world and all of that. You've discovered the law of attraction, and so there's a trap in everything. Let's face it. But yeah, bringing it down to the minutiae, the mundane, and to the bodily somatic experiences. So I think as a tonic. And maybe this relates to the marijuana use and the giving it up as a tonic for these visions. I would say, you know, trust less in the visions, or maybe not at all, and put your trust in more what's happening in your body. In your body. Well, in the mundane as well, just the everyday stuff that's happening outside of you. But most of all, like your sensations that's physically happening in your body. Because that's how memory, how trauma is reintegrated, not as grand visions. Judging by Whitley, I mean, he had all the grand visions you could hope for to reintegrate his trauma, but no, he ended up writing 20 books and having a ministry about how we're in touch with some incredible cosmic other. No integration occurred. And that's because, letting in... Okay, so I'll use an example now. I don't think I told you, or rather, I don't think I've said this on the podcast. I might have done. A couple of years ago, so this would have been after I started Crucifixions, because that definitely did stir a lot up, I started having nightmares. I'm not sure if it was a series or only a couple, but anyway, one occasion I woke up screaming, and I was in absolute terror, and there was no tangible reason for the terror. There was no dream content, never mind anything actually in my waking world, but the terror itself was real. And to give you a sense of the terror, because I was interpreting it after I woke up, it was as if, the way I chose to imagine it, as if the Manson family had crashed through the door, and I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was, me and my wife, my cat, were all about to be tortured to death. And there was nothing I could do about it. That was the level of terror, which is not a terror that I imagine. You know, I've seen movies and all, but generally to really viscerally experience that terror, I don't think I'd ever really thought about just how utterly terrifying it would be to be in that situation.
I was waiting to be skinned, the same terror.
Oh, really?
You know, shaking, waiting for everyone to turn up for a public skinning.
Oh, right. So that's very close analogy then.
Yeah.
Right. So what I take from that, what I took from that, is that terror was in my body.
Yeah.
It was still trapped in my body from an experience I had, not of the Manson family, but of some sort of attack from outside of me, some sort of abuse that was experienced to me at that level of absolute annihilating terror.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is what integration feels like. Not exclusively, not all bad, but in terms of just having a bodily memory with nothing attached to it, no visions, nothing, it's just experiencing it right now.
Across some quite strange emotions that seem to have a physical agony with them. Like my father died at New Year, and I just got this ball. It's not here today, but last week it was here, and it's not stomach ache. It doesn't feel like it's actually physical, but it hurts as if it was physical.
Where is it?
It's in my stomach, sort of.
And that's now.
That, no, it's not now. It's gone today. It woke up without it, but it's been the last sort of 4 days, 5 days, just this gut, like, I can't even really, I don't have any words to describe it, really. Just a ball of angst and incredible agony, emotional agony, that makes me cry if I stop and feel it and sob, you know. But I don't know what it's about. I mean, I liken it to being about my father, who left when I was 5, so, you know, it really was an ordeal because I was there when he left. And I don't know whether it's touching that, but I can't, it hasn't got any, you know, it hasn't got any images, hasn't got any words that go with it. It's just this sort of ball of, and it feels physical, and not a sensation I've really felt for.
So physical, but also emotional when you tune into it.
Yeah.
It's like a package of emotions.
Yeah, being sort of played in the body.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking of a record turntable, you know, the needle, like that's the body and the sound is the emotion.
Well, it's also like something you swallow, it's in your stomach. So a very intense package of emotion that was more than you could consciously allow yourself to experience, much less process. So then you pushed it down, you swallowed it, swallowed the pain.
Yeah, and intellectually I link this up with my father dying and the memory I have of him actually walking out and my mother just screaming, and then he came back to calm her down and then went again, and I was there for the whole thing and saw it. And I think from then on I didn't trust adults. Something happened to me then. And my trauma could just be that. And yet the symptoms that you talked about yesterday, I also experienced some of them. So it's difficult to say.
Well, anyway, you know, the absence of the father in that way, the abandonment or the casting out or a bit of both, because it's, you know, the metaphor of the death of God, so it is the, you know, the ultimate abandonment kind of narrative, but also it's what it allows for. Like, if the father is absent or indifferent, as in my case, both, what does that allow to happen without the father's protection?
Will it we become stronger and stand up for ourselves?
No. Only as a constructed identity. Not at 5, you don't.
No, but I think as time goes on, we learn to perceive deeper. You know, there's something that's come out of all of the trauma.
Oh yeah, well, I'm not going to be the downer, but I think it's premature to put a positive spin on it,
yeah,
at least in terms of where I was going with this. You know, if the father isn't attendant, not only do you not have an example of masculinity, therefore a way to individuate, because that's the masculine principle, but just at a mundane level, they're not there looking out for you. Of course, a father can be abusive and sexually abusive and all the rest of it, but that's even worse. But if we're not, you know, assuming that the father, if we're not going there, I would just say that a father who's not actually looking out for you means that you're much more vulnerable to predation.
And I do feel as though I've been scampering my entire life to get daddy's attention from anyone.
Right.
There's a part of my ego that's attention seeking. Needs attention of someone to confirm it, to make it feel like it exists.
Sure. And again, there's these two layers, because if we need, as children, we need that confirmation that this is the right way, this is the wrong way, to develop a sense of what's real and unreal. So there's that, but then there's also, like, if we are in jeopardy in any way, then we desperately need the attention of the parent, particularly the father, to save us, to rescue us. Mm-hmm. So then what we think of as this neurotic drive for validation and attention, and we think, oh God, why can't I get over it? You know, it's
over myself.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it is neurotic, but it's
yeah.
It's in.
I think I dreamt up a father figure, so all of my fantasies was dreaming up a father figure to validate me and to take my side and to give me the attention. I mean, this is all just becoming clear now over this last year of sort of writing and depth analysis. That, oh my God, yeah.
Well, it's like Whitley in The Key.
I haven't read it, but I actually thought today I ought to read some of that stuff. But I don't know whether it will lead me astray. I'm a little bit weary.
No, you don't have to read it because you're reading Prisoner Infinity. So that's how I interpreted The Key, was in exactly the terms that you just said, that Whitley needed to conjure up this...
Yeah.
This perfect father figure to validate him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that's occurred with me, and then it becomes a kind of monster,
mm-hmm.
A disembodied spirit or a thought form which has some sort of autonomy, even in your own head. It is automated. Whether you want it there or not, it's there. Trying to get rid of it then it's like exercising a demon, or it feels like a possession.
Yeah.
These psychoses that I've been through have helped me to let go more and more of that thought form, that automation. It fades. Because as you said earlier, you know, you shouldn't trust these visions. I don't. And I start to package it all like this is all full of error. You know, it's all an error. As much truth as there may be in it is impossible to say. And I have to put my faith in the truth will sort of rise to the surface. You know, it doesn't need props, does it? It doesn't need anyone to provide proof. It is what is.
No, it doesn't need symbolification, if that's a word.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be represented as language or symbols. Or...
Yeah. And that these visions are really just mirrors of my own psyche, my own craziness. And yet there does seem, and I've had confirmation, there does seem to be something else going on.
Yeah, well, they're also they may also be coping mechanisms, like a way for your mind to actually participate in it and to interpret what's happening in a way that they can understand it, as I was sort of just saying a moment ago.
There seems to be a kibosh as well, like it's trying to kibosh it as well, you know, lead me astray.
Down. Yeah. Sure, that's the guardian, of course, prevent integration at any cost. Yeah. And it can do it, it can be good cop or bad cop. It can do it through threats and torture and self-abuse, persecution, or it can do it through, you know, seduction and bigging you up and promising to protect you and keep you safe and all of those things.
Yeah, distrust what you have trusted up to now. For example, the Matrix Warrior was key. So it was saying, that's where it started, that's the evil, throw it away. Where it was quite key for my own understanding. And when I watched The Matrix, I started looking for books because I'm like, we live in a Matrix. This movie's true somehow. I mean, I was only 20.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, it's more the sense of urgency and the sense of needing to do something, and of course to demonize or to attribute the problem outside of you. So, or that there's a kernel of truth maybe in that decision, which is that you don't want to get trapped by symbols anymore or by representations of the experience because they're all traps. But you know, obviously throwing away books is not going to actually free you from that tendency.
I really wanted that yoga book as well. Read it.
Do you do yoga then?
Sometimes when I'm together enough I get a lot from it. I did practice it a few years ago, but it's been, I don't know, the last few years falling apart. and allowing it to just happen. I can't fight anymore. I can't function with this stitched together persona. It's shoddy and it doesn't work, and it needs to just fall down, so I let it fall down. I'm in a position I'm lucky enough to be able to. And that seems to be coming to an end. I've done all this writing, and another of the voices is don't publish anything, you'll just poison everybody that reads it.
Right.
With more untruth. And I think the last few days I've been like, really, wow, you know, there's a sort of pull to understand this. So it's been really good to talk and unpack it a bit and think, well, I don't really need to understand it. It's just what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Or help to sort of open the sluice gates a bit so it can start to go. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So do you do any physical?
I just walk the dog at the moment.
Do you do anything like meditation?
Yeah. Try to do it as often as I can remember, to just bring yourself back to the moment and try and feel the sensations of the body and try to watch the thoughts rather than be the thoughts, which is getting easier to do, to just see the thoughts happening in the emptiness that I am. I do have a sense that that was maybe the end of it. But I've said that before, so.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it to me. No, I mean, integration is, it was a very long process, so. It just seemed like there was a lot that came in these visions, a lot more than you could process mentally, certainly.
Because they're visual as well, like, you know, I don't have words to describe what I've seen.
No, but even what you did describe, and we haven't talked about it much this time, but like yesterday there was such a lot to talk about there. Not that it would necessarily be productive, but there's certainly... you did receive a lot of information, whether it was good or not, that's clear. And once you've received information, like,
it's just floating around with nothing.
It's there, yeah, you can't really forget it. You can't just flush it.
It fades as time goes on.
I mean, of course I've had these experiences, I mean, visions where I just, like, my life is forever changed now that I know this, and I guess it was, in a sense, but, and of course that's Matrix Warrior and other books have been spawned by those experiences, and my attempt to turn them into a coherent narrative, and fortunately, my relative failure to do so, I
don't know. I think I got a lot from them, which is what I wanted to convey to you when I first contacted you. That you've, you've blazed a trail that I stumbled over, and thank God somebody else has blazed this trail, because I don't think I would have been able to make sense of it. You know, particularly the Streber work. You know, I'm not interested in Streber. It was a great way of thinking, okay, this is really grounded. This looks at all angles. It doesn't just fly off in some fanciful, you know, Castaneda-esque kind of crusade. It's really looking at the meat and potatoes, the psychology, and the trauma behind it. And, you know, it was really news to me when I came across it. But it has always felt quite synchronistic, like you contacting me now. It's always been like this. I didn't know Jake Horsley-Allais and ALF Keepers were even the same people, same person.
Try like hell to set the other free. Why is it still so hard to see? Thank you.
really hard to talk to me when my mum was here, and I'm just having a conversation with some disembodied voice that's just beating 10 barrels of shit out of me, you know.
Right.
Dirty, dirty, skanky addict, you know, everything coming at me, and I just can't fight it.
No. No, you wouldn't want to fight it, I don't think. But yeah, that must be very distressing.
It's distressing for my mum to hear it as well, because I'm actually speaking what it's saying to me. So I've got two voices, look like Sméagol from Lord of the Rings, you know. She must just look horrendous.
Right. So this was an episode, or this was an ongoing thing?
What do you mean?
Well, it was one incident, or it's happened a few times?
It's happened a few times, yeah.
Hmm. And how does she react to that?
Stop listening to the voices, Marianne. They're not real. Okay. Hell's not real.
Right. Oh, so she reacts in a reasonable fashion. Then. She doesn't just run out of the room or call up the emergency.
No, she did leave, though, at one point. She said, if you don't leave, we'll all be skinned as well. And please leave, please. So she did go, and she didn't call the police.
Mm.
I think she just spent the night praying for me.
And you're living with her?
No.
Oh, okay. So she just happened to be there, or you called her?
I'd called her because, yeah, she's kind of the only person I had.
Oh. So, okay. You didn't mention her before, though, when I said, did you have anyone? You went straight to friends, which is...
Well, I just don't really like to bring her into it because, bless her... You know, I don't want to worry her, and I can't, and she doesn't understand. She kind of makes it worse.
Okay.
Because she's looking from such a matrix dwelling perspective.
Mm.
She doesn't have the perspective for to hold it.
Well, speaking of matrix dwelling, and this is perhaps for, if we, maybe we can have a third conversation and, about this, that you've read what I've written in different places, I imagine, at least some of it, about the enmeshment in the mother's psyche.
Yes.
So, why don't you, I'll give you an assignment, not really, but just think about that in terms of your relationship with your mother and the thing, everything you've been through, because I was going to bring it up earlier in this conversation about the father, like the father being there to protect you, a rescue, right? And if that is the primary rescue that every child needs, is from the mother's psyche.
That's the father rescuing us from
the mother's psyche. Because until then you are one with the mother, yeah? You can't distinguish where you end and your mother begins.
No, but I became extremely hostile toward my mother. I blamed her for my father leaving, all my problems, because she's neurotic and clean freak and quite unemotional, quite sterile. And I ran away. I moved in with my father when I was 15, and I left him when I was 19 and went to London to get away from them all.
When did he die then?
He only died New Year gone.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, so very recent.
Which has brought up a lot of, I mean, I did counselling quite a long time ago, and I recognised there was a problem with my father because I couldn't hear anything bad said against him.
Mm.
And that in itself became quite a red flag, like, what? And now he's died in the year of him being sick, I've been able to finally let in that, no, he did let me down, he did abandon me, all my problems, a good lot of them came from that.
Mm.
And he wasn't a good role model, you know. He was a kind of drinking, parties, no responsibility, you know, fuck it all, lavish lifestyle, not quite as more entrepreneurial, kind of maverick, new money. And whereas my mother was so very steady and 2.4 kids, Barrett home, goes to work every day, keeps everything absolutely pristine, and is totally neurotic about it. I mean, they were chalk and cheese. And I always looked up to my father and sort of saw my mother as really quite tragic. You've not left the house ever.
Right. So that's polarity.
She'd given me all those traits of not feeling confident, my shyness, my social anxiety.
Mm.
I blamed her for having transmitted them onto me, because I recognised as my primary caregiver I was bound to pick up her personality.
Right, so that fits. I mean, there's the polarity there, is the magical of your father, the mundane is your mother, mm-hmm. which is archetypal, of course, the matter and spirit. But then also if your mother chose that, not chose really, but ended up in that very mundane, kind of debased, sort of overly socialized role that so many...
Hugely lonely, no friends.
All of that. Then she would... What happened to that unlived psychic life, let's say? That unlived inner life?
Of my mother?
Yeah.
Yeah, what did happen to it?
So it may be that your psychotic visions, in a sense, are her disowned stuff, yeah. The stuff she's not allowing herself to be conscious of, then you're having to process it for her in some regard. Oversimplifying, yeah. But worth thinking.
When I said to my mother about what Grandad had done, she said, oh yes, he used to do that to me. And I was like, and you let him stay in my room at night? I mean, because she couldn't acknowledge. And even when she said it, it was, oh yes, it was, it's nothing. Well, it was something. Because when I realised what had been happening, I felt totally betrayed and disgusted with my own self. You know, I still have problems. I've got sexual hang-ups because of it.
So what was it? I don't think you'd specify.
Tickling and making me tickle him, and, you know, so I don't like opening my legs because it just feels like there's a gross, wrinkly old man there.
Well, you mean he would tickle you between your legs?
Yeah.
Right, so it's not really tickling then, is it? It's a euphemism.
Yes.
Right.
And I think there was a kissing as well, me on him.
Crikey. Right, so he did that to her when she was a child, and when did she know that he was doing it to you? At what point did she know?
Well, a couple of years ago when I told her.
Yeah.
5-6 years ago, and yes, he used to do it to me. And when I told my dad, he said, oh, that makes a lot of sense, because your mother wouldn't like this, that and the other. She wouldn't let me do those things, and she was funny about, and she's quite frigid, and I am, so I do think it was a problem. And I get the itching all the time.
Right, so yeah, that's a real cluster there, or, you know? Can of worms, use that cliche. That does seem to be all interconnected there.
Because he was my surrogate father figure as well. He was the great granddad, he was loads of fun.
After your father was cast out, you mean?
After he left.
Oh, he left.
He abandoned us, yeah.
Well, sounds like he was driven off to some extent. If there was screamed,
possibly
if there
by
was
my
screamed
mom.
Out.
Yeah, she wanted that, you know. For example, my dad told me a story where he'd gone and got a lawnmower because Mum wanted the lawnmower, and he mowed the lawn, and she said, well, it's not got any stripes on it. I wanted stripes, you know. She was kind of like, and yeah, I can see, you know, strode me mad. So strode Dad mad.
Well, that may be more than a figure of speech at this point.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling. Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain.
Well, that's it. I didn't actually get to do a third conversation with Murray as I had hoped. Not to say that won't happen. If you'd like to hear more conversations between myself and Murray, then just let me know. It can be arranged, I think. Next week, the podcast will be two parts with two different reader listeners, one from the good old US of A and the other from the deep north or the high north, from Sweden, whatever. I have just submitted a piece on the reality of ritual abuse, what you should know about organized satanic ritual abuse. For disinfo, I decided not to submit my more polemical response to their article just yet, and present a more substantial kind of evidence-based piece to at least lay the groundwork. So that's been very much on my mind, the ritual abuse thing again, and just how surprising it is to discover just how much evidence there is for it, and always has been, despite what the majority of people claim to believe. I have to say claim, because seeing as it's as widespread as it seems to be, then there must be many more people who are involved either as victims or perpetrators in organized abuse than possible to imagine. But anyway, what else am I going to say about that? Oh yeah, and I've just finished Prisoners of Infinity, the whole thing, ready for posting it, and somehow the ritual abuse element does intersect quite fundamentally with the Streber and the abduction narrative. Not surprisingly, perhaps. Anyway, I seem to be getting closer to the core of things, both internally and externally. So it seems like it's quite an exciting time in the realm of horticulture and the liminal space that we are occupying together. That's it. Many, many thanks to Andy and Steve for your generous donations. This makes a mind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his leg came tumbling down. Your brain, monkey said to man, my desire is